I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to part two of Walking the Dog with comedian Angela Barnes and her beautiful cockapoo, Tina. Really hope you enjoy. Here's Angela and Tina and Ray Ray.
Did you suffer from depression?
I did, for a long time. And actually, I had quite a wobbly year last year, if I'm honest. So one of the reasons it was a bit late meeting you. I was going to meet you earlier today, but I forgot that Thursday morning is my therapy morning. So I went straight from therapy to more therapy, it feels like. So I'm at that age, you know, perimenopause sort of age. And last year I had a real wobble with it. Sort of HRT and all of that business. And the ADHD meds I had a bad reaction to them, so I had to come off them. And it was all just a bit bleak and a bit sort of, I suddenly felt old and a bit kind of, the world's changing a little bit in our industry, you know, that with the way kind of social media is, and I just felt like a bit of a dinosaur. And I think you feel that more as a woman anyway, because, you know, you're allowed to be old as a woman if you also happen to look 30, then you're allowed to be 60. But if you're, do you know what I mean?
If you look like one of the Real Housewives of Beverly Hills,
then you're allowed to age.
You can be 50.
Yeah. But if you just are a normal woman, then that's not allowed. No one wants to see that. Ugh. You know, and I started having a bit of a crisis of, okay, well, is it time to start looking at what else you can do? You know, is it time to look at those transferable skills and kind of... And I really had a bit of a existential wobble last year because I don't feel like I'm done yet in comedy. You know, I feel like I've got a lot to give. But unfortunately, people need to want what you're giving, you know, and I really worried about it. And then I started having some therapy and I changed my HRT and things like that. And touch wood, I think I'd got a bit of, what's the word? There's a word I'm looking for. A bit of perspective, I guess. I think I'd sort of gone down this hole and everything, I'd catastrophised, which is what I want to do.
Right, and I would say, well, I was just watching your ITV special the other night.
Right, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And so I get it. I'm looking at your outsides and your insides feel very different.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking, oh, the other week I watched Angela's ITV special of her hugely successful tour, Hot Mess. I mean, most comedians would dream of that. And then I see... And I'm not, by the way, diminishing how you're feeling.
No, no, no. I'm
just reminding you that it's so interesting that I look at that and I think I saw her ITV special. Then I saw her do this incredible thing, the show called The World's Most Dangerous Road.
Oh, yes, with
Rod Gilbert, where they're driving across Italy doing this. So I'm thinking she's at her absolute peak. But you're not feeling that. And why is that?
It's so funny that the sort of... I mean, that's part of what depression is kind of, not willfully, but just not being able to see the evidence as it is in front of you. Like, with World's Most Dangerous Roads, we filmed that in June last year, and it was sort of maybe a couple of months after that that I started to take this little tumble. When I was on tour, the second half of my tour, I got COVID, and so I had to cancel a few tour dates and reschedule them. And it really hit me, this bout of COVID I had. And then I sort of went back a bit sooner than I should have done, really. I didn't have COVID anymore, but I just hadn't recovered.
You weren't match fit. Yeah.
I wasn't match fit at all. And I went and did a show in Birmingham, and it was the sickest I've ever been doing a show. Like, I don't know how I got through it. And the next day, I was supposed to have a show in Evesham in Worcestershire, and I was with my support act, who's also a good friend of mine, Michael Fabry, and we were driving to the show, and I just had this, what I now know, was a panic attack like I've never had before. Because I lost feeling in my legs and both my arms. And I just fell. And I literally, and my hands went into these claw shapes. And I thought I was having a stroke. I thought, oh, I don't want to die in Evesham. So he drove me to A&E. Like, I was in a... real estate, and they sort of did ECGs and all sorts of things. I had to cancel my show that night because I was supposed to be going to a show. And they just came back and said, what you've had is a really brutal panic attack, and you need to take some time out, really, and slow down. And I was getting stage fright. I did, which I'd never had before. So, you know, you get nervous for gigs, but I remember doing a show at the Brighton Dome. It was, we do a show every year in memory of Phil Gerrard, my friend, the stand-up who died. And me and Romesh put it on. And Romesh was hosting it this last year. And I was backstage and I just didn't want to go on at this. And he was like, are you all right? I've never seen you like this. And I sort of said, I don't know where this has come from, but I just didn't want to get on stage. Which is a problem when that's your, you know, what you do for a living and you're in the middle of a tour. And so I was taking beta blockers. I was just to get myself on stage every night to do the shows.
Was Romesh helpful in that situation?
He's, you know, a busy man, and I wasn't very honest with people because you don't want to show weakness, you know? You don't want to show that you're struggling. So you just play it down and go, oh, no, I'm fine. I'm just having a wobble or whatever. And obviously those closest to me knew. I just wasn't sleeping. Anyway, so I had a breakdown, really, is what happened in the autumn. So my tour finished in December, and I just took a bit of time out. So December, January, I didn't really do much work. I was still doing my podcast and things, but I just sort of sorted myself out. I went to see a menopause specialist and started therapy and started to, you know, different HRT and things like that, and touch wood, you know, started, because the other thing as well is I know I feel better if I do some exercise. Like if I swim a couple of times a week, it makes a huge difference.
I know, isn't it annoying?
But I know, really annoying, because you don't want that to be the case, but it really is. And then, is that a we? Yes, Tina, not me. And if you're busy, it's hard to fit that in, because, you know, it's like, well, I've got a drive to Manchester on Tuesday, and then I've got this meeting on Wednesday, and then, you know, and if I'm sure you're the same as me with your ADHD, I can't handle too many appointments in one day. I feel overwhelmed, even if that appointment is a Zoom call.
Can I just say, Andrew and I have discussed this.
Yeah.
Previously, she hasn't just outed me.
No, we have talked about this before.
You and your ADHD. What?
Is this my what? Oh, did you not know, Emily?
So, Angela, you got diagnosed with ADHD a couple of years ago.
Yeah, 2021. Yeah.
Yeah, and I feel like, when you were diagnosed, it felt like the end of a sort of mystery.
Yeah, it helped me explain a lot of things in my life that up till a diagnosis, the only word I had for them really was failure.
Mm.
And I thought I just wasn't very good at certain things, or I just couldn't, you know, didn't meet those arbitrary life goals other people meet. And I wasn't, just thought I wasn't a very good human. You know, I just wasn't very good at humaning. And that wasn't a nice feeling, really. And it was frustrating. And I couldn't understand why I couldn't do these simple things that other people took for granted.
Like what things?
Well, like, you know, having a task that you want to do and just doing it. I remember growing up, the phrase I can hear from my dad rattling through time is just, if you just do it, then it's done. Just do it, then it's done. Because I would have things I needed to do and I'd be so worried about getting them wrong or failing or it being bad or someone, that it would paralyse me from doing it. And it's like with writing, with anything. I love writing comedy. It's my favourite thing. So why am I finding it hard to sit down and do it sometimes? And I realised it's this fear of failure, this fear of... Because as soon as you've written a joke, you're going to have to say it in front of people and it might fail. You know, you're going to be judged on it. And the fear of that was just paralysing me.
Right, and I think that's something which people who aren't familiar with ADHD and just associate it with boys shaking their leg a lot in a chair at school.
Yeah.
What that's to do with is a dysphoria around rejection as well.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
The idea that people with the kind of ADHD you have, which presents much more typically in females, there's an emotional aspect to it, which is rejection feels like nothing on earth.
And to the point where, you know, doing what I do, you get a lot of negativity on social media and things. And people say, well, just ignore it. And I do, I don't look at it. But if I do stumble across it, it feels so personal, because even though I don't know that person, and, you know, people will say, well, I mean, look at their... Why do you want that person to like you? You go, it's not about that person, it's about me. And that feeling of rejection, that feeling of... It's a horrible feeling that somebody that doesn't know you doesn't like you. And to me, that is just a... But I've not done anything to them. You know, I can understand someone not liking me if they know me and I'm not their cup of tea or what. Bottom line is, it doesn't matter. If I'm never going to meet these people, why should I care? I know that intellectually. But this fear of rejection is a real thing with people, particularly women with ADHD. And it's this sort of disproportionate reaction to it. And a very emotional gut reaction to it. So... And our job has a lot of rejection in it. You know, a lot of jobs we go for, we don't get a lot of... and like you say, you look at your peers and you go, well, they've got that, I should be doing that. And it all sort of can build up. And I think that's part of what happened to me last year, was I focused on that too much. And like you say, I didn't do, you know, what got me to 5 out of 10. I did, why aren't I at 10 out of 10 all the time? And you can't be, you know, and actually... There's, gosh, so many people who would kill for my career and what I do. And I'm grateful for, not grateful for that, but, you know, I'm grateful to be where I am. And actually, I'm in quite a sweet spot, because I can walk through town and I don't get bothered by people. And I don't, you know, I can get the tube and not be bothered by people. And usually if people do recognise me, which doesn't happen very often, but if they do, they're nice. They say, oh, you're Angela, aren't you? And, yeah, you know, and I don't get stick or...
Yeah, because they recognise you from... TV.
Yeah.
And your live gigs as well.
Yeah, from that, or from, funnily enough, I suddenly got a spike in being recognised after doing House of Games. That was the thing. People blooming love House of Games.
The thing you hear an awful lot these days is everyone's got ADHD now.
Yeah, that old chestnut.
How do you respond to that when someone says that to you?
It's funny, because people very rarely say it to your face when they know that you've been diagnosed. The way I sort of address it is, I know it feels like that at the moment, because no one knows how many people are neurodiverse, right? No one knows what that percentage of the population is. And the way I describe it to people, try and get them to understand, is it's a bit like left-handedness, right? There was a time when people who were left-handed were forced to write with their right hand, because being left-handed was sinister and weird. Now we accept that a percentage of people are left-handed. We live in a right-handed world because most people are right-handed, so society's set up for them. Well, it's the same with neurodiversity, right? A proportion, be it 5%, 20%, we don't know, of people, their brains aren't neurotypical in various different ways, be that autism, ADHD, dyslexia, whatever it is. But the world is set up for the majority, because it has to be. So for that 20%, 5%, whatever it is, they find life difficult in a way that if you're neurotypical, you won't. And so that's just a fact. But in the past, what might have happened to those people is they might have ended up in crime. They might have ended up with depression, like I was, being treated for that, you know, could have ended up taking their lives. Who knows? Because you don't understand. Like, knowledge is power, and people are scared of labelling people. But for me, I was like, when I didn't have a label, all I had was failure. But having a label gives me a reason, not an excuse or anything else, but a reason, which means that now I can accept that there's some things I can't do in life and some things I can. And the world's not going to change to accommodate me. That's fine. I'm not asking it to. All I'm asking is that acknowledgement that I do exist and I'm not making it up. It's real. And the reason it feels like, oh, everyone's got ADHD at the moment, is because, say it is 20% of the population. That guy, I can't do the maths now. That's what, 12 million people? In this country, that's a lot of people to get diagnosed. So, yeah, if 12 million people are suddenly realising something about themselves, that's going to feel like, oh, everyone's got ADHD, everyone's got this, everyone's... I've had people tell me it's fashionable. And I want to say to them, I want you to go to my 20s and watch my life. See me in hospital wanting to kill myself. See that person and tell that person, aren't they lucky it's fashionable to have ADHD now? Aren't they lucky? You don't know me or my life or what I've been through, so don't judge me on that. You know, but, you know, and the other thing I say is, well, people didn't know what heart disease was till they knew what heart disease was, but no one was going, oh, everyone's got heart disease, sit down and eat your lard sandwich and get on with it. Like, that's just, you know. So that's my answer to people who say that. And you're not going to change some people's minds because some people don't like hearing. I think what part of it comes from is some people don't like hearing that they interpret it that being too neurotypical means we're telling them their lives were easy and ours weren't. It's not what we're saying. But people don't like being told that they're typical and they're normal and their lives were. Mm. So by being neurodiverse, it's like we're making ourselves special. That's how they see it. And they want to go, you're not special.
Well, it's almost a bit like, I suppose, with the comedy world, where it was just straight white men on that circuit.
Yeah.
The reason there was some resistance to that when women came along and when, you know, more diversity was expected was, but we've always been happy doing it this way, and now you're coming along and telling us our way isn't the only way.
Yeah.
And is there an element of that as well?
I think so, yeah.
That we have to bend to accommodate you.
Yeah,
now.
Why should we accommodate you?
Right.
Us neurotypical people to fit in. Why do you think you're special? And then but those same people will moan about crime and punishment, and they'll moan about, you know, oh, there's youths running amok and there's this, that and the other. It's the same people. We go, yeah, but if those people were given what they needed, you know, weren't forced to learn in this Victorian way that we still do education in this country, like it works when we know it doesn't, then maybe you wouldn't have people breaking into your car every 5 minutes, or, you know, these things are all related, but they won't see it like that, because people can only think with their own brains and can only see the world through their own eyes, and so they can't understand that other people's brains work differently and see things differently.
I found this, I got a very helpful piece of advice from a friend of mine, you know, who's also a friend of yours, who's no longer with us, sadly. It's Gareth Richards.
Oh, yeah, lovely Gareth.
Who's a comic who really sadly died last year. And Angela, you were very sweet. I always remember, you know, it was in the news a bit just because we did a radio show with Frank Skinner with him. And
yeah.
Frank mentioned it on air and was understandably very emotionally distraught. And, you know, as these things do, they obviously got picked up by the media. But I remember you were one of the first people to reach out and say, you weren't asking for gossip, for want of a better word. You weren't saying, what's happened? You just said, I just want you to know I'm devastated and I'm really thinking. And you sent me a beautiful picture of you and Gareth, and I think with Tina.
Gareth with Tina, yeah. Because Gareth had supported me on a few tour shows. And he is when Tina was a puppy, and he used to sit with her in the green room while I was doing the show. So I had a lovely photo of him with her in one of the green rooms.
But, you know, he said to me, Gareth, and I, you find, I'm getting really emotional now.
That's oh, so you're okay.
Weird.
Oh, come here. No.
So weird.
It's so fresh, isn't it? It's only been a year.
It's because it's a year. It's the anniversary.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry. Yeah, you know what? Gareth said something to me which was really helpful.
Mm.
And I used to talk to him about ADHD, and I remember saying to him, well, I was telling a friend about something that I was struggling with, you know, an executive function thing.
Yeah.
And she said, what you need to do is train your brain. I'm like you, but I just train my brain. I've worked hard. I've trained my brain. And Gareth said, that's exactly what a neurotypical person would say.
Yeah.
And do you know what? I said that to her next time.
Great.
And she understood.
Yeah.
There was no aggression about it. And I thought it was a real example of how, in the way that you've just really brilliantly summed up how to respond, which, by the way, I will be writing down, and I want the transcript, because I've never heard that so brilliantly put before.
Oh, thank you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra.
Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, look at
you. Hello, gently Tina, it's all right. There we go, it looks like you a bit.
I like this dog's got a little
She's got one like that. She's got one, it's luminous yellow.
Oh, I'm obsessed by this dog's.
It's gorgeous, isn't it?
Can I just say, there's a dog in a onesie, which I'm all over. It does look a bit like a man. There's a dog in a sort of pyjama suit.
And it does look like a man who's escaped the hospital.
Because the dog just cocked his leg and I felt disgusted, like it was a man doing it.
How dare you?
I don't think a dog in clothes should cock its leg, do you?
No, I know what you mean. If you're going to act like a human being, going to dress like a human being, act like one.
That's a lame dog. If you're going to wear our clothes, use our toilet facilities.
Imagine but wouldn't that be weirder if you'd seen him stood at a urinal? That might have been weirder.
I would have had a lot more respect for that dog. I really went off it when it cocked its leg.
Oh,
don't go in our shops and buy our clothes. I need to congratulate you on your brilliant podcast.
Oh, thank you.
That you do with John O'Farrell.
Lovely John O'Farrell.
And it's a history-based podcast. Will you tell us a bit more about it? I know all about it.
So it's called We Are History. It is a history podcast, but don't let that put you off, because it's not a heavy... John and I are not historians. We're slightly nerdy about history, but we like learning about stuff. So what we say is we read the history books so you don't have to. So basically, we'll read something that interests us and then we'll do a podcast episode about it so you can learn about it, but in a more fun way than reading a dense history book or listening to a dense history podcast with, you know, people who actually know what they're talking about. I mean, it's one of my favourite things that I do, but, you know, the least lucrative, which is always the way. But it's a real little passion project of ours. So we've just done our... God, I think like our 10th series or something crazy. It's in the middle of it now. So it's just We Are History. It's on all your pod players and stuff. And it's just every week we choose something that interests us. And it's pretty diverse. It could be anything from, you know, the sewers of London to... We've done Profumo Affair. We've done nudism in Germany. It was a topic we did. All sorts of...
And you just did... one on Live Aid.
We did.
Which I heard, which was fascinating.
So John O'Farrell, the only downside of working with John O'Farrell, he's the most prolific, but he makes you feel lazy, because since we've been doing this podcast, he's written two musicals. So he wrote Mrs. Doubtfire, a musical that's on in the West End at the moment, and he wrote the Live Aid musical, which is on at the Old Vic at the minute. And he wrote Chicken Run, which came out at Christmas. Chicken Run 2, he wrote that. And he's just... I went last night to the book launch of his new novel. So he's all right, calm down, mate. That'll do for now.
It's really clear, Angela, listening to your podcast, that you two just genuinely have a lovely dynamic and energy and friendship.
We do. Well, there's this... Because we didn't know each other before the podcast, really. It was 10 years ago, John came to see my Edinburgh show in... Well, Edinburgh... and he wrote a nice tweet about it, and I saw it and said, oh, thanks. I knew who he was and sort of wrote back and said, oh, that was very nice, thank you for coming to the show. And then every now and then, you know, just on Twitter, like you would do before Twitter was a human bin fire, you know, you just sort of comment occasionally on things people posted or whatever. And then I decided I wanted to do a history podcast because I sort of had this... It's what I was interested in, and I read a lot about history and stuff, and I wanted to, because I didn't study history really at school, and I wished I had, but I just hadn't, you know, school had sort of put me off it. And so I wanted people to find the fun in it like I had a little bit. And I thought, I don't want to do this on my own, because it's a lot of work on your own. It'd be nice to have someone to bounce off. And I thought, who? And John had written a couple of sort of funny history books that I'd listened to in the car on the way to gigs, you know, like audiobooks. And so I thought, well, you can't hurt to ask. So I sent him a message. Yeah. And he apparently, I now know, he's got a daughter, Lily, who's in her 20s. And he asked her, he said, oh, Angela Barnes has asked me if I should do a podcast with her. Do you think I should do it? And she was like, well, yeah, obviously.
Thank you, Lily.
So thank you, Lily. And so we started doing it, and we've been doing it a few years now. And yeah, people... really, you know, we've got a really nice fan base. They really enjoy it and they really interact with us about the stuff that we do.
Here's a question, Angela.
Yeah.
Why are people so obsessed, and I include myself,
yeah,
why do people love Henry VIII and that whole period?
Which is interesting, isn't it? Because it's not a period that I really have been that sort of the whole Tudor thing and the whole sort of Henry VIII thing. And it's, I know, I mean, I love the musical Six. I'm sort of a modern history freak. So I originally pitched to John that we should do 20th century, a podcast about the 20th century. And he was like, no, we'll run out of things to talk about. Let's just do all history. Gives us more scope.
And you're like, damn, trying to avoid that extra workload.
I know, haven't you got a bit of a crush on Henry VIII? Isn't that your sort of shouldn't but would?
A bit.
Yeah.
I have...
She likes a bad boy.
A framed photo. It was in my bedroom. Under pressure, I removed it. It's now in my living room. Obsessed.
Yeah, that's weird. You think you could fix him, don't you? That's the problem. You'd see Henry VIII and go, ah, you just hadn't met me. That's the thing.
Can I say, as a redhead, I find your views very disloyal to your people.
It's very much from a box, this redhead. there's no real redhead under this.
What's Raymond doing, Angela?
What is Raymond doing? He's sort of having a little nibble on some leaves, I think. There we are. They're his
Come
leaves
on,
now.
Raymond, let's get away from this.
Or some deforestation going on.
There's a digger man. Isn't it funny?
Looks like quite a nice little way to spend an afternoon, didn't it? On your own in a little digger.
I remember one of my parents' godsons, and he used to say that he wanted to be a digger man when he was older. He now owns an art gallery, I think. So.
Quite different. Well, I said to my husband once, because I sometimes feel guilty that I've kind of got my dream job and I feel very lucky. And, you know, my husband's got a regular job, a good job, but it's, you know. And I said, well, what would your dream job be? If you could give that up and do, you know, whatever you want to do, what would that be? And he really had to think about it. And the thing he came up with, was I'd like to be one of those guys who cleans windows in skyscrapers, like with a harness, because he loves like climbing and stuff. He's like, and just like dangling from a thing, cleaning windows.
It's sort of the modern day gladiator.
Yeah, kind of. I was like, okay.
Because there's jeopardy.
Slight element of danger, but also nothing, it's not brain work.
And you met your other half. You met him online?
I did. So it was 10 years ago. And I found it quite hard. Being, at that point, I was very much a comic playing the clubs on the road, you know, and I just had no social life, really, because every weekend I was gigging and just, you know, gigging as much as I could to sort of make ends meet, really. So, and I sort of knew fairly early on that I wasn't very interested in dating a comedian, because
why?
I think one comedian in a relationship is one too many, really.
Why?
I just think, I don't know, I think part of it was, maybe it's my own insecurity of that, I didn't want to date someone that I'm effectively, that I felt in competition with, maybe, or I don't know what it was. But I hadn't met a comic that I'd never had a relationship with a comic. So I sort of joined the internet dating thing and did it a bit half-heartedly for a bit. And then one day I was looking at it and Matt, my now husband, on his profile, he said that he grew up in Great Yarmouth. And I'd like I saw his pictures and he looked very friendly and nice. And Great Yarmouth is where my dad had his sex shop.
So, did you drop that in on your first
day? Message? Yeah, I sent him a message. Oh, you grew up in Great Yarmouth. My dad ran the sex shop in Market Square. And so he says, like, well, I couldn't ignore that, could I?
So you know what? I think that's a great opener, because how he coped with that will tell you if he's the right person for you. Was that what you were sort of doing in a way?
I think so, yeah. I think I must have sent it and then gone, why did you mention that, you idiot? That's not a thing you mentioned. But anyway, he messaged me back. And our first date was quite funny, because I shouldn't laugh, really, but... God bless it. This was back in 2014, and I'd had a friend of mine who I dated when I was in my 20s, or like 19 or 20 or something, when I dated him. And we'd stayed friends, this Australian guy, but he unfortunately was a big drinker, and he very sadly passed away when he was 43. And so he died earlier that year. And my first date with my now husband, he lived in North London and I lived in South London at the time. I lived in Crystal Palace and he lived in Finsbury Park. And so he very thoughtfully found a lovely little pub on the river for us to have our first date in. And he said, it's sort of halfway between us, so, and it's the transport's easy. And he put so much planning into where we should have our first date. I didn't want to tell him that that was the pub that was run by my ex-boyfriend who'd just died. I didn't want to tell him that. So our first date, I walked into this pub and my ex had died like a month before. And he'd been my ex many, many years before, like over 10 years before, but we'd stayed friends. And so walking into that pub was quite emotional, really. And I just sort of walked in, but we had a really nice first date. I didn't tell him till much later, maybe about a year later. I was like,
what did he say?
He said, why didn't you say we could have met somewhere else? I was like, you put so much thought into it, and it is a lovely pub.
Well, I'm really glad you did end up meeting each other.
Yeah, me too. I did all right, I think.
I loved your show, Angela, that I saw. It was on, it was filmed and it was on ITV. I mean, I'm telling you this. I'm sure you've been given a heads up by your agent. But it was called Hot Mess. And a lot of material you did about the, you know, being an older, in inverted commas, bride.
Yeah. I think one of the benefits of getting married a bit older, it was funny because there was a big assumption by a lot of people, like in the wedding dress shops or in the, you know, in the wedding industry, if you like, that it was our second marriage. And it wasn't for either of us, it was our first.
You know what they were expecting?
Trouser suit.
Trouser suit, and you know what else?
Go on.
Two livid stepchildren giving me filthy looks.
Of course, bridesmaids.
That's what I say. I said, someone said, do you think we'll ever get married? I said, at this stage in the game, it's going to be forgiving trouser suit and two angry stepchildren.
What was nice about our wedding, I think, and we had a beautiful day, but we very much did what we wanted to do. For a start, we were paying for our own wedding, so no one else had any say in anything anyway. And I think when you get to a certain age, I remember going to a lot of weddings in my 20s and early 30s, and a lot of parents had more say than they should have had in some of them. There's a lot of weddings I went to, like, I can't tell one from the other in my head. I can't remember which was which. And I desperately didn't want that. You know, I didn't want because we got married in 2021, I had sort of a bit of time during the pandemic, during the lockdowns, I kind of planned the wedding I wanted.
Yeah.
But in a sort of not a bridezillary way. I mean, just in that we just hired a field and put some tents in it and just had a party. And it was great because it was a really sunny, lovely weekend and nobody had been to a party for 2 years.
I was going to put him down, Angela. Let's see. We'll give him one last go.
Oh, bless you. You're going to need a bath, aren't you? Does he like being bathed?
I've got a confession to make. Once I let him get in the bath with me.
You have to sometimes. She gets in, you like put her in the shower, but you have to get in with her.
Have you ever done that?
Oh, yeah.
He's like my child.
Yeah. Well, they are, aren't they? When we don't have children, so.
No, we forgot.
Yeah. And I, as I always say, it's not going to happen now. My reproductive system's like an Asda on an Easter Monday. Yeah, some eggs left, but they're shit.
Mine's like, you're the ones your gran used to send you.
Really cheap, nasty chocolate.
And like, really stale.
They've got a bit white. And
hello.
Hi.
Hello, doggy. What's this one called?
This is Willow.
Hello, this is Tina and this is Raymond. Lovely to meet you.
Nice to meet you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, Willow.
Oh, she's gorgeous. She's having a great time.
Oh.
Yeah, Tina's a nightmare for rolling in things. We took her to, we spent a Christmas down at Canberra Sands and we were having Christmas Day walk on the beach and Tina was running up and down the beach having the best time. And then Matt said, what's that she's running towards? That big rock. And we looked and she'd climbed inside a seal carcass. Like a dead seal on the beach. It was the smell. It was... and she was so proud of herself.
Oh.
She just came out like, you're welcome. Don't I smell great?
Come on, Ray. Yeah, I really loved your show.
Thank you. Hot Thank mess. You for watching it.
It's interesting when you talk about... I guess not feeling
confident, you know, and having those moments of self-doubt, I wonder if your secret weapon is your vulnerability.
Maybe. I do think, for me, I think complacency is the enemy of comedy, right? And I think the minute you think you're a great comic, or you start behaving like you're a great comic, and then it all just comes easy, you stop trying. There's a danger you'll stop trying. And then when you stop trying, you know, you start phoning it in or whatever.
Bye-bye, Woods.
Bye, Woods. That was lovely. Our special place, Em.
Thank you.
Aww.
Makes us sound like doggers.
Should we get the car and come back? Good job my dad's not still here. We'd probably find him there.
Do you know what? I think we can safely say it's what he would have wanted.
It's absolutely, he'd be so proud. Forget the career in comedy.
Bye bye, Woods. I love saying goodbye to Woods.
Oh, Woods. Aww. Got me as mad as you are. Bye to some Woods. Oh, this is so lovely.
Isn't it lovely? Yeah, I think we should, you know. It's really you know, we were talking earlier about how. I keep telling you what we've been doing, but there we go. We were talking earlier about someone who'd given you some great advice, which was when you say, how's today, it's a 5 out of 10, you say, great, what brought it to a 5?
Yeah.
And you know what? Today has gone possibly from like quite a 3 to me.
Oh.
I'm at the 7 mark now.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Bit of fresh air.
That's what it is.
Dogging in the woods.
Bit of Angela.
No.
Oh, we're back at the garden centre, Ange.
Oh, we are. We've done a full loop. Look at that.
Shall we get you a little snack for the way home, Ray?
Oh, how is he in the car? Does he mind the car?
Do you know, he has a lovely sleep. I might put on some Angela Barnes and John O'Farrell.
Oh, lovely. That's sent anyone to sleep. It's funny, though. People do say that to you. I listen to your podcast when I'm going to sleep. You're like, oh, thanks. I think.
And why don't we say our goodbyes here?
It's been so lovely. Thank you for having me back.
I've loved it. And Tina, you've been an absolute star.
She's got a tail between her legs now. She knows I'm going to put her in the car. Oh. She doesn't like it. Bye-bye, Ray. So good to see you. You beautiful little fellow, aren't you? Yes, you are. That little face. I just want to... Oh.
Is that me or Ray?
But both.
I really hope you enjoyed that episode of Walking the Dog. We'd love it if you subscribed, and do join us next time on Walking the Dog, wherever you get your podcasts.